From ESG Post in Singapore, I'm Zara Maung, and this is the ESG Podcast. At a time when the logistics industry is facing increasing pressure to tackle its carbon emissions, I discussed the challenges of sustainable logistics with Mariam Al-Fudairi, Head of Marketing and Corporate Social Responsibility at the global logistics company Agility. Thank you for joining me, Mariam. Could you give me some background on Agility and its sustainability achievements to date?
So Agility is a global logistics company. We're about a $5.1 billion company, and we operate in 100 countries. And what we do is logistics. So we help companies of all sizes, including some of the world's largest companies, move cargo from point A to B. So imagine, you know, the world of logistics touches almost everything that you can physically touch, whether it's pharmaceuticals that are moving from, you know, generic manufacturers in India into Europe, or whether it's clothes that are manufactured in Bangladesh and that are moving to shops all around the world, or toys, or phones, or printers, or hard drives. These are all, you know, the things that we move. When it comes to sustainability, Agility has been working in this space for a very long time. I was lucky enough to join the company about 14 years ago at a very interesting period in the company's sort of history, if you like. The company had grown from becoming the largest logistics company in the Middle East to being a global logistics player, largely through acquisition. We had acquired 40 different companies in a space of less than 5 years. And the company was sort of searching for its identity. Who was it going to be in this new phase of its growth and its development? What was the culture that was going to bind all of these different acquisitions together, and sort of trying to find its way? And the first part was rebranding and sort of adopting the name Agility, but the larger soul searching was around culture and company DNA. And we started talking about sustainability in that context, you know, so more than a decade and a half ago. And over that period of time, if I sort of look back and I think about what's changed at the company or what we've been able to achieve, I would say there are a few things that really stand out. The first is our humanitarian logistics program. And so this is a program that started out as a collaboration under the auspices of the World Economic Forum with other logistics companies like UPS and Maersk and others to provide pro bono humanitarian logistics during times of massive natural disasters or crises. So I think that's a huge one. I think the other really big one that we're particularly, you know, sort of involved with and engaged with is our human rights program. So if you look at our operational footprint as a company, 85% of our people work in the Middle East and they work in Asia. And they work in environments where there are differing levels of regulations around, you know, labor laws and differing levels of enforcement when it comes to labor laws. And on top of that, you know, we work in very operational industry. So, you know, we have a lot of warehouse, people who work in a warehouse and people who drive trucks. And on top of that, a lot of, you know, especially in the Middle East, a lot of our workers are migrant workers from Asia that have come to work in the Middle East. And so I think we've had to really map out a lot of the standards as it applies to our industry and that it applies to these emerging markets when it comes to human rights in the supply chain. And this is an area that, you know, we've invested heavily in, and we think about, you know, our 100% goals are, so, you know, 100% of our HR and country organizations doing self-assessments to understand and identify their own human rights risks. 100% of our employees trained on their rights, and then 100% of our operations audited by a third party. And we are making tremendous progress towards those goals. We report them publicly and we report progress on them publicly. And I think that's just been a really exciting thing to see unfold.
And what would you say were the biggest sustainability challenges and opportunities faced by Agility today, and how are you addressing them? So moving forwards from what you've already achieved.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the big area and the really difficult sort of alligator that we're wrestling with, I'm not sure that's the right metaphor, is, this notion of getting to zero and what it looks like in our industry. And this is something that logistics companies, big logistics companies, are really putting a lot of time and effort into thinking about, because we're part of a highly polluting industry. It's transportation after all, transportation by air, by ocean, and by truck. And what do true strides, environmental strides, mean for our industry? What does it mean for our business? And what does it mean for our customers? Given that, most of the purchasing decisions, and therefore the logistics decisions, are actually in the hands of customers. So for example, for Agility, we don't own, for the most part, planes and ships. We work with people that own planes and ships, and we bring together the shippers at, say, one of the world's largest sports apparel manufacturers, with actual assets that are moving the sports apparel around the world. And so what does that look like? What does, how do you think about the environment in that context? How do you think about your own operations? How do you think about your customer operations? What are, sensible targets? What's achievable, especially in emerging markets? Like, so much of the conversation that occurs in let's say places like Europe around alternative fuels, or moving to, trucking standards, or moving to trucks of certain, and with certain emission standards, or even the conversation around renewables, which is heavily subsidized by the government. So much of that doesn't apply in many of the emerging markets in which we operate or have large operations. So I think that's really the big issue that we're thinking about a lot, and mapping quite a bit as we think about the future.
And does that actually lend itself to opportunities as well? Do you see an opportunity for low carbon transport within your markets?
I think it's a really mixed picture. I would love to say yes. I would love to say an unqualified yes. But I would say the reality on the ground is much more nuanced than that. It's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be straightforward, especially in emerging markets. And I think I think what has the potential to be game changing is technology. And I can give you a couple of examples, right, of sort of potential environmental benefits in our industry because of digitization and because of technology investment. So, for example, one area that Agility is actually investing in is road freight platforms for markets like Brazil or Saudi Arabia, where you have huge distances that are being traveled by trucks, and half of the time the trucks are traveling empty, major contributor to sort of global greenhouse gases. So okay, a road freight platform, which you might invest in not for environmental reasons, you might invest in it because you think it's a great business idea, but has environmental implications because you're actually able to optimize where the truck is moving and make sure that the truck doesn't travel empty. I think things like that have potential. Another example is and another company that Agility has actually invested in, again, is a startup based out of the US that is looking at hybrid technology for existing fleets. And I think that's huge, because so much of the conversation around hybrids and electric vehicles, etc., focuses on new fleets, but that's just not the reality for emerging markets. The ability to buy completely new vehicles isn't likely to happen en masse and at scale. But if you think about this hybrid technology that can be retrofitted to a truck within 30 minutes and actually convert an existing fleet into a hybrid, well, that's really exciting, and that has potential in emerging markets. So I think it's not a slam dunk. I can't tell you that I see huge opportunities, yes. I also think it's going to be hard and a long road. So I would say it's a mixed picture.
You don't actually own most of the transport logistics that you utilise. Does that make it difficult for you to try and instigate a change towards low carbon? Are you contributing to investing in that? Or is that something that you just require from your operations and your suppliers?
Yeah, so I would say the it's less about requirements and more about constant engagement and management, right? So what it comes down to is conversations up, down, and sideways. And what I mean by that is up when it comes to customers. So a lot of the work that we do with customers is helping them think through their supply chains and how we optimize their supply chains. So, you know, where can we move and think about, you know, how they manufacture things to make it the most efficient from a logistics perspective. And here there's a ray of light, right? So the great thing about logistics is that good logistics is usually green logistics too, because it's efficient. It's efficient in terms of time, it's efficient in terms of cost, it's efficient in terms of carbon. So you have this constant engagement with customers around thinking through environment as one dimension of their supply chain, not the only dimension, but one dimension of their sort of supply chain strategy. And then you have the conversations with your suppliers, right? So again, it's constant engagement. Sometimes you're bound by the reality of what's available in a particular country, but the constant engagement with suppliers, and certainly with our big suppliers, so like our airline companies and our ocean carriers, we engage with them regularly through industry forums like the Global Maritime Forum, like Business for Social Responsibility's Clean Cargo Working Group, to try to create, you know, common understandings of the how we're going to account for emissions and what, you know, what low carbon means for our industry collectively, so that we're holding ourselves accountable collectively to a set of shared standards and a shared way of thinking about these issues. And so I think, you know, it's that kind of constant discussion that is required to truly make a difference in this space. And it's, you know, very deep thinking work that happens in multiple parts of the company, from our sales to our operations to our sustainability team. And that's the approach.
How do you actually balance all of these different needs, the environmental, low carbon push, the need to be price competitive, and also your commitment to fair working conditions?
I truly and sincerely believe that well-managed companies think about management along different dimensions and have to manage across different dimensions and build the discipline to manage across different dimensions. That's, you know, that's sort of the definition of being a good company, if you like. And I think, you know, you think about these issues, it's no different from managing your finances well and managing your operations well and managing your customer responsiveness well. These are disciplines that you have to build within a company. And, you know, it is a competitive industry. And I think you also have to be really realistic and really clear with yourself sort of internally around where your lines are drawn. So I would say things like health and safety, human rights, these are non-negotiable. You know, you're in a people business. You take care of the people in your business, full stop, no discussion. There's just nothing to think about. You just have to build, as I said, the management discipline to sort of make it happen. When it comes to the environment, I think there is a lot to think about. And, you know, cost and environment and time. These are the three big things that a customer, and therefore we on behalf of a customer, will think about when it comes to logistics. And that is a balancing act. And there, a lot of it is about managing information. So how do you have the information available to allow your customers to make informed decisions? Informed decisions about, you know, I'm going to do it this way and not that way. I'm going to use this carrier and not that carrier. Or if I choose to do it, you know, if I choose to move something by air and not by ocean, I understand the environmental implications as well as the sort of cost and time implications of that decision that I've made. So I think, you know, I think that's part and parcel of doing business in today's world. And I also think that it's not just about being competitive today, it's also being competitive 20 years from now. And I think companies that do not build these disciplines will inevitably fall behind, partly because regulation is catching up. In many areas, a lot of this stuff is still voluntary, but it won't be in 5 to 8 years. So, you know, might as well be ahead of the curve. And also because customers are demanding things that, again, things that were nice to have 5 years ago are no longer nice to have. So, you know, we, for example, did an assessment of the number of our customers that ask us about social and environmental issues as part of the RFP process and as a prerequisite to bid, and that take it seriously, not that just, you know, put it on, you know, a document so that you check the box. And we realize that it represents 25% of our revenue, which is actually huge, right? So the demand is coming, you know, so it's regulatory demand, it's customer demand. The supplier community is sort of also thinking about this space because, you know, their customers are thinking about this space. So I think if you want to stay competitive, you have to think about these issues.
You've already expressed your commitment to fair working conditions. How do you track your working conditions within your operations and supply chains and the human rights as well?
I think in this space, there's just such variation in different countries around, you know, business culture and understanding of certain things. And I think the way you have to track it is with absolute clarity around this is, you know, crystal clear, this is how we play. So our global human rights policy is a two-page document, and it's very clear, very simple, very high level. Behind that, we have sort of a management guide that runs hundreds of pages along with different scenarios around how you think about different things and how you manage the nuance, which for most people is the day-to-day, you know, environment that they work in. Extensive training for our managers as well as for our employees. So managers understand, you know, how you manage nuance in different scenarios, and so that employees can say, but I know my rights. These are my rights. Agility has publicly committed to these rights. Agility has committed to me when I sign my contract that these are my rights and I can defend them. And then I think the big thing is let somebody else do the tracking for you. So this is why our goal is 100% third-party audits. So we do META audits. They're conducted by third-party auditing organizations. The results are, again, publicly available. If a customer wants to know how we're doing in a country, and say, okay, this is the audit report. You know, this is exactly how we're doing in the country. It's available here. Go look it up. This is where we are. And so we create this accountability loop. But before we get to the point of auditing, we invest a tremendous amount of time in building that common understanding.
And what do you do if you find unacceptable working conditions or attitudes to human rights in your operations and supply chains? Do you have a procedure for dealing with those? What about whistleblowers? Do you protect those people and do you have a way of dealing with those issues?
Yeah, so I think protection for complainants is a huge issue and a super important one, and you need to sort of lead with that, right? So we have a third-party company that answers a hotline. It's an anonymous hotline. Anyone can call in. It has phone numbers in 100 countries. There's also an email address, and there's, you know, sort of a website where people can call in and make complaints. And we also have sort of internal channels, so with our ethics and compliance team, where people can report concerns, and you know it's a no retaliation policy, and that's a really important part of sort of the culture and conversation around human rights issues. But I think, you know, these issues, I mean, I'll give you a typical issue that, you know, is not easy to resolve. Take migrant workers who come to the Middle East, for example, from usually the subcontinent in Asia, and you know, they're recruited to come work for Agility or anybody else, any one of our competitors and any industry that recruits sort of workers, you know, construction, manufacturing, you name it. There's a whole web of labor agencies that are behind how people get recruited. So, you know, somebody will go and recruit in, you know, a rural part of a particular country and say, hey, come work for us. But you have to pay us these fees, these quote unquote fees to come work for me. And one agency will pass on this person to another agency, to another agency, to another agency, and fees will be taken all along the way. And then they'll be sent over to the Middle East. And by the time somebody arrives, that person might have paid, you know, like they might like literally be indentured for years to pay off these fees, these quote unquote fees to the labor agencies, which are completely illegal. And you would think that it's as easy as saying, okay, well, obviously I'm going to have a contract with my labor agency that says you can't take fees, right? And that's going to solve the problem. But it's not that easy because, you know, you might have that contract with your labor agency or your labor agency, but your labor agency might not have taken a fee, but there might be behind your labor agency, there might be 10 other labor agencies that did take a fee, right? And so the reason that human rights in the supply chain is such a big issue is because supply chains are complex and they involve multiple parties. So how do you then deal with an issue like that? And so for us, that has meant things like we send our own representative on recruiting trips. Let's say we're recruiting in the subcontinent or somewhere in Asia. We send our own representatives from our agility offices in those countries who speak the local language to speak to our to potential employees and say, you are going to be asked to sign a piece of paper that says, we do not take recruitment fees from you, but you also have to understand we really mean it. You do not have to pay any recruitment fees to work for Agility. And if you have paid for recruitment fees, you need to tell us so that we can sort of, you know, deal with this issue with the labor agencies. And we also write into our contract financial guarantees, right, that say if we audit our people and we find that you've taken fees from them, we will recover the costs from you, the agency, and we will return those fees to people. So like you have to build in, it's not just, you know, contractual language say you don't do it. You have to build in this sort of complex system. Again, it comes back to the same thing, awareness, making people aware of their rights, training the ecosystem, training your subcontractors and your labor agencies before you start working with them, and then putting in place these guarantees, contractual guarantees, and then auditing to make sure that the whole loop is closed and that your supply chain is clean.
And do you engage with the labor unions? Are migrant workers, for example, represented?
So our largest migrant worker population is based in the Middle East, and pretty much across the board in most of the countries in which we have large operations, labor unions are not permitted. So, and by that, I mean labor unions are not permitted by the governments. And so in countries where there are labor unions and where labor unions are lawful, do we permit freedom of, I mean, we permit freedom of association everywhere, and we deal with labor unions where there are labor unions to be dealt with. I mean, yes, we have operations in Europe and the US, but our largest operations are in parts of the world that don't have these, for the most part, external watchdogs. These institutions are not very strong, right? So it's a lot of internal regulation plus third party auditing by, you know, sort of certified human rights auditors that are coming in and looking at our operations to provide that critical outside lens and make sure that what we're doing is what we say we're going to do.
You mentioned that your customers are interested in ESG issues. Which ESG issues are most important to them? And are you competing with other logistics companies on these issues? And if so, how do you compare?
So obviously it depends on the customer and it depends on the industry and it depends on the geographic location of the customer. So you actually see really different questions being posed from companies in different parts of the world. So for our European and US-based customers, we see a lot of questions around the environment. For companies in the retail industry in particular, human rights is a major concern. For companies based in emerging markets, it's a mixed bag. You see some people that are very interested in environment, human rights issues. You also see a lot of interest in what we're doing in the community investment space. So a lot of interest in things like our education and entrepreneurship initiatives and how we build coalitions with other community organizations or other companies in this space, right? So there's no one-size-fits-all answer to that question. In terms of how we compare to other logistics companies, I think it's a very fair question and one that we ask ourselves a lot as well. So if you look at EcoVadis, which is again a sort of third party organization that rates tens of thousands of suppliers in this space, we've been listed as being in the top 13% of all companies worldwide when it comes to ESG issues, top 4% when it comes to issues like environment in our industry. So I think we're tracking quite well. I think we've been a leader in this space for a very long time. That said, I also think that there is a lot more interest. In the last 5 years, there's been a lot more interest in this space more broadly, and we're especially in Europe. And so we're seeing many of our large competitors who are European-based become more involved in this space, which is a good thing, and we welcome that. You know, it's very good, and it helps us all collectively be better.
Do you actually have carbon emissions targets, for example, for the next 5 to 10 years? Are you looking at science-based targets and how you fit in with those? And moving forward to the net zero carbon economy, what role do you see yourself fulfilling in that environment?
Yeah, so I would say let me answer those sort of in the order that they came. Do we have targets? Yes, we do. So our target right now is the 25% reduction in emissions by 2025 in our own operations, and we're tracking to that goal. I mean, this year we just finished installing a few days ago, actually started installing, not finished installing, you know, solar panels across all of our roofs in Singapore. We've done, you know, major solar investments in places like Dubai, where we have huge warehousing facilities, and a number of other things related to reducing our own carbon footprint. I think the bigger question, though, when it comes to our carbon footprint is not what we do ourselves, because again, if you look at our footprint, 3% is owned and operated by us, 97% is outsourced. So yes, the 3%, we have targets and we'll work on those targets, but the big question is, what do you do to the 97%? And that is, again, these big conversations with customers and with suppliers in our industry around what does that mean together. And I don't think there's an answer or even a clear set of answers. I think this is an evolving conversation. And I think there's a lot of work to be done in this space, honestly. In terms of science-based targets, we've signed up for science-based targets, and we're spending a lot of time and effort internally right now trying to understand exactly what that means for different parts of our business. Because for our logistics business, it means one thing. For our logistics parks business, which is, you know, basically the construction of warehousing, large-scale warehousing facilities in across Africa and the Middle East, we're the largest private owner and developer of industrial real estate in that part of the world, it means something else. And so, you know, and then for some of our subsidiary companies, it means a third thing. So really thinking about that in great detail for different parts of business and coming up with differentiated strategies for different parts of the business. And, you know, a net carbon zero economy, I think that's a really hard question, and I won't greenwash the answer. I think it's going to be really difficult for our company, and I think it's going to be really difficult for our industry. And I think that exact question is the question. Right? It's the question. So what does that mean for us? Practically, what does that mean? What infrastructure investments does that imply? What does that mean for, you know, manufacturing and where manufacturing is located? What does that mean for, you know, the transportation, the next generation of transportation assets that we invest in? What does that mean for the technologies that we invest in around, you know, greening the supply chain? And I won't tell you that I have the answer to that, because I don't, or we don't.
Are you actually working to develop the answers to that? Are you working in partnership with agencies, for example?
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's where I think this whole notion of engagement becomes so critical, right? So this is where all of these associations that we have, and we have, you know, we're involved in sort of probably five major industry partnerships in this space, are related to trying to figure this out, and not trying to figure this out alone or trying to figure this out in isolation, because the supply chains, like, and logistics is all about the ecosystem, and there are multiple players in the ecosystem. And so that's exactly, you know, I mean, these big questions are what we're wrestling with and talking with other people with, and working with, you know, strategic partners like the World Economic Forum and others on, is to try to come up with realistic answers, real timelines, and proofs of concept that will allow us to try, test, and learn.
Thank you so much for talking to me, Mariam.
A pleasure, Zara, a pleasure. Thank you for having me on your podcast.